everybody. Thank you for coming to our afternoon session. This will be the last of the sessions where all five of us are going to be kind of leading a conversation. This week we've kind of talked about the Abrahamic traditions, or three of the Abrahamic traditions, and their sort of conversation and values around economy, environment, and the other, quote unquote. And this, of course, is partially brought to you by the Tracy Levine Center, which is an organization I work for, and we're going to be working on trying to help build multi-faith partnerships around the state, around Washington State. And then our conversation here today is in partnership with the Faith Action Network, which is a partnership for the common good. So we have Amber here, and we have Carol here representing them and leading the conversation. And so the whole conversation will work, just like the other ones, we'll do a brief introduction to the challenge or the question we're talking about. Each of us will have 10 minutes to reflect. We'll talk to each other for a few minutes, and then we'll have time for Q&A, and then we're going to stand up. And, you know, last time, like, some people stood up and, like, weren't, like, wanting to do the whole policy conversation, and to do so is not a sin. Could I just say that? It's not a sin to, like, say you don't want to be part of that. Like, that's okay. Because we want folks to be willing. And then we're going to have interaction with the Faith Action Network, but I think it's going to be really, like today's going to be a really important day to think of, to do that work. So today we're going to talk about how do our traditions envision our responsibility to the other. And so I'll do the brief introduction here. So we know that in the last 3 to 4 years, hate crimes in the United States have been rising rather dramatically. And of course, the group most impacted by hate crimes are our African American brothers and sisters, our Jewish sisters and brothers. The Muslim community has seen an incredible increase in hate crimes. Latinx folks, LGBTQIA folk, people with disabilities of some kind or another have all seen, we've seen from the Southern Poverty Law Center, from the FBI statistics, and from other kind of human rights organizations, that hate crimes are on the increase. And there are a plethora of ideas about why that's happening. And none of them are adequate, exactly. And so the way I like to talk about that in the work that I do to try to resist that kind of otherization of people is that we have a stew pot of hatred, right, that has multiple Bunsen burners working on that stew pot and making it bubble and boil. And there's a whole lot of things. And so the question for us as people of faith is, what do we do? What are the deep values that we bring to recognizing other people as human? And so we're going to first start off with Adam, and then Johanna, and then I'm going to share a little bit. So, Brother Adam.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. I've kind of broken down my presentation into the past, so kind of what Muslims and the other was in the past, and a little bit in the present and what the future should look like. So, hope I didn't break any rules of yours, Jerry. Okay. So, regarding Muslim texts, Jews and Christians are referred to in the Quran, in the Holy Book of Muslims, as the people of the book, Ahlul Kitab, which means the people of the book. And so, Muslims believe that the Torah came to Moses and the Gospels were given to Jesus, and so we do believe that our book affirms what they had as well. And so we refer to them as people of the book. And one of the things that means practically is that we can eat their meat, because usually meat specifically, we had a long conversation today about kosher and halal, and actually how similar it is in terms of the way it's done, where the animal is, it's meant to be slaughtered very efficiently, with to the jugular, and to be drained of blood, because we are not allowed to eat blood, and then a prayer is said over that, and so Muslims are comfortable eating, for example, kosher meat, for example. And then the rabbi also told me that many Jews are comfortable eating halal for the similar reason. And so when an animal is slaughtered, all that is mentioned is in the name of God, God is the greatest, and then the animal is slaughtered. And the animal should be kept away from other animals. So there's this whole etiquette around that, so that it does not see other animals being slaughtered. It should be kept by itself. And the knife should be sharp so that it does not take multiple strikes, and so on. And even in those days, it doesn't mean that Muslims were big meat eaters. Because I know maybe sometimes that becomes the implication of that, because the camels and goats and sheep and all of that was their livelihood, being in the desert. So it was not something that was often done. They didn't eat meat all the time. Anyway, it's going off on a tangent. But I did discuss a few things yesterday in my presentation. I'll kind of repeat some of those things. There is a verse in the Quran that says, La ikraha fi din, in Arabic, which means let there be no compulsion, absolutely no compulsion in religion. And the special form is used, which means absolutely no compulsion, no exceptions to that rule. And so that means both without, meaning into Islam, it also means within Islam as well. And that is the rule. Now anyone who breaks that rule is doing it of their own desires and their own individual, and is only representing themselves. When Muhammad entered Medina, there was a number of Jewish and other non-Muslim entities, Jewish tribes as well as non-Muslim entities, who lived in Medina. Medina was the city where he was exiled to after the oppression of the leading tribe, which was his own tribe, became too much, and the persecution there became too much. And so he left to Medina, and at Medina he established a contract with the Jewish tribes, and as well as the other whatever entities were left. It was mainly the Jewish tribes. And one of the things in there was that if they had disagreements amongst themselves, then it would be left for them to solve in their own courts amongst their leaders. But if they wished to have it judged by Muhammad, then he could do that only if they wanted that. So it was not. So they were able to have their own family law, and even their law of other things as well, whether it was theft or murder or whatever, within their tribes. Also throughout many Muslim civilizations, whether it was the Iraqi or the Mughals in South Asia, or the Muslims in Spain, protection of Jews was a big deal, and that ability for Jews to practice their law to a degree was also protected as well. Obviously, nowadays modern Muslim countries are honestly ruled by brutal dictators that have been installed by Western governments and authoritarians who care very little about what Islam has to say on a topic. It was Muhammad who said that, I will complain to God about a person on the Day of Judgment who curtails the rights of a non-Muslim minority. And he said, I protect Christians wherever they may be, north, south, east, and west. In my protection, they are within my protection, within my covenant, and I will secure them against all harm. So that was his words. But obviously, in many modern countries, that is not followed, unfortunately. And that goes down to people not really caring about what Islam has to say until it fits their agenda, or until they can use it within their agenda, unfortunately. And there are some who do well by that, but then there's many who don't, unfortunately. And then people also ask about, and that kind of brings me, that's kind of the history of it, and I wanted to spend some time on that, but I also want to talk about the present, because today, Muslims have become the other, for many, if not many people in America. Muslims have become that other that we don't really know what they are about, we don't really know what to say. Even when my wife and I come here to Holden, the first few days, people are kind of, they don't know what to say or how to do it. I know part of it is politeness and things like that. But then usually after Vespers, that's when people are like, they have something to say, I guess, some common ground. So I think finding that common ground is really important. But people also ask a lot of times, well, why don't Muslims speak out when something bad happens?
Oh, boy.
Right? And there was a teenage girl, 17 years old, who was frustrated by the number of people who used to ask this question, because Muslims do it, press releases, but no one really wants, that doesn't get clicks. Muslims condemn this. It doesn't really get clicks on a website, does it? It doesn't sell ads or ad space. So she started a website called MuslimsCondemn.org, and there you can find hundreds and if not thousands, of Muslims who condemn attacks or, you know, violence and so on. So Muslims do speak out, and I think Pastor Terry said it best in one presentation we were giving, I think it was in Federal Way, where he said that Muslims are, there's enough Muslims in this country, 1%, for Muslims to be noticed, but not enough of them to be understood. Because if there was more of us, then we could probably get out there and be understood. But unfortunately, that's not the case. And so that's why we rely on people such as yourselves to help us get that word out. In the Quran, God says he has created us in nations and tribes so that we get to know one another. So seeking diversity and getting to know one another is actually a part of our faith. And it's a purpose given to why God created us so different. Why did God create us in so many different nations and tribes? Why can't we all look the same or have the same skin color or the same language or the same culture? And so he explains that part of that diversity is one of his signs, and that our purpose is to go and get to know one another. And so that's really powerful. And that's actually at the end of many verses that talk about not making fun of each other, not calling each other names, about the brotherhood, sisterhood, and all those kinds of things. There was actually a study that was done about people who live in a homogenous neighborhood where everyone is the same. And 52% of them said that they prefer to live in a more diverse community. And then 80% of people who live in a diverse community say they want to stay there, they don't want to leave. So you can see that power there, right? If you have diversity, you get kebabs, you get nice food, right? You get lentils, dal, like we have today, right? You get hummus, right? So that's always great. And that speaks to our natural desire to have diversity. Unfortunately, as Muslims have become the other, assaults against Muslims, as the pastor mentioned, have risen across the board, and they're increasing year by year. So it was first 20%, then 30%, then as of a year or two ago, 67%. We had a mosque in Bellevue that was burned down twice. It was burned down once, and then burned down again. Luckily, they didn't rebuild it. It was just half of it that remained that was also burned down by someone. And the sign at our mosque at MAPS was also vandalized a few times. And the federal rhetoric doesn't make it easy. Just this week, you know, Pastor, you're going to talk about that. Just this week, I know we're kind of disconnected, but Pastor likes to stay connected, so he'll update us as to what's happening there. And so since this is my last presentation here at Holden, I'd really like to ask, well, what can we do? And that's where the future comes into play, and I'll finish with that. There was a question that was asked, a survey that was done, that said, in their hearts, Muslims want to impose their religious law on everyone else in the country. It was a survey that was done. And 85% of people disagreed with this fact. So it was a do you agree or disagree kind of question. That in their hearts, Muslims want to impose their law on everyone else, their religious law. And so 85% of people disagreed if they happen to actually know a Muslim. And if they did not know, it was almost half, that was 48%. So it seems like a really important kind of trigger here, or important point here that I get from this, is to actually go and meet a Muslim. And that kind of, you're like, oh, it's just normal. Their kid's crying, you know, he's running around and they're chasing after him, you know. And, you know, they drink water and eat food just like us, right? So I think that's a very important thing that has to happen. And so my request to all of you, first of all, is gratitude for sharing your space, sacred space here, the altar at Vespers, this space here. This is obviously the place you go to connect with your faith. And so for you to share that is a really big deal. And it's not easy for us to kind of get out there because there's few of us. And so for you to go out and actually find that connection and find that space with the right person. I mean, you know, finding the right person who can actually do that, making that happen is actually really important. And if you come to our mosque, you'll see it's not perfect in terms of how welcoming it is, but we try to be as welcoming as we can. We always have blind spots, and any time we do anything, we always have blind spots. But that's the spirit of Islam that we wish to embody, which is that welcoming nature. And there are many mosques. I know that the frequent question I heard throughout the week was, but are all mosques like that? Can really, because I'm from Minnesota, or I'm from Portland, or I'm from here, I'm from there, will I really find a mosque like yours? And the fact of the matter is that you will. An easy way is obviously go to Google Maps, type in mosque, and find one that has a bunch of reviews, right? Because that usually means that there's a lot of people going there, right? Whether it's a lot of them, there'll be Muslim reviews, but that just means there's a lot of people going there, and so they probably have the facility, space, and wherewithal to actually welcome people. A lot of times if a community is very small, they're just kind of within themselves, and they don't really have the resources to reach out. But if it's a larger mosque, then usually it has that ability. You'll be fine as long as you stick to that Google review strategy. I hope it works. So, one thing, I couldn't find the image. I didn't have access to the internet, but was when the New Zealand shooting happened. We've been able to build a lot of allies in Western Washington, and 2,000 people showed up to our mosque to support our community in that difficult time. And the really powerful image that's kind of just engraved in my mind, I guess, is when we were praying. And as a part of our prayer, it was the sunset prayer. As a part of our prayer, we have to bow down in prostration. So our heads are towards the ground and our backside is up and we can't see what's around us. And it was then when all of the people, they kind of came close to us and raised their signs that said, "We love our Muslim neighbors." Mm-hmm. And that was so powerful. Like, we have your back, we're at your mm-hmm. side, wow. Right? I wish I had that image. Terry, you were there, right?
I was there.
Rabbi, were you there? I can't remember.
I was not there. I was there.
You're in Olympia, though, so I understand.
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah. Carol was there, yeah. That image was so powerful, and I think if we can recreate moments like those of interfaith solidarity, I think that would be really powerful. So that's it for me. Thank you.
Thank you.
So the most repeated mitzvah commandment in the Torah in the five books, more than 36 times, so we like to say 36 because that's double chai, double the symbol of life, is that you shall love the stranger and you shall not reject the stranger. So that's repeated over and over and over again, more than any other law. And what I wanted to focus on today was you shall love the stranger, but also the second part of that, which is usually because you were a stranger in a strange land, because you were the stranger. And so as we go through some of these texts, I invite you to reflect on how they shape us in terms of remembering times when we felt outcast, and how it's that empathy and that relating to our own experience that as individuals and then larger as a community that can help us face the other. So in Leviticus we learn, you shall not hate your kinfolk in your heart. Reprove your kinsman, but incur no guilt because of him. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against your countrymen. Love your fellow, your neighbor, as yourself. I am the Lord. When a stranger resides in your land, you shall not wrong him. The stranger who resides with you shall be to you as one of your citizens. You shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. That always seems to be come with this reminder, is that there was a time when you were oppressed and you were constricted and where you were strange, and remember that at any time and place, you could be the stranger. What kind of world do we want to create? The Hebrew Bible contains the great command, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, and this has often been taken as the basis of biblical morality. But it is not, and this is the Jonathan Sacks who was mentioned before speaking. But it is not, it is only part of it. The Jewish sages noted that on only one occasion does the Hebrew Bible command us to love our neighbor, but in 37 places it commands us to love the stranger. Our neighbor is one we love because he is like ourselves. The stranger is one we are taught to love precisely because he is not like ourselves. Mm-hmm. And this would be next from Baba Metzia from the Talmud. Our rabbis taught, he who wounds the feelings of the proselyte, this is the convert, transgresses three negative injunctions, and he who oppresses him infringes two. Wherein does wronging differ? Because the three negative injunctions are stated, you shall not wrong a stranger, and if a stranger sojourns with thee in your land, you shall not wrong him, and ye shall not therefore wrong each of his fellow man, a proselyte being included in fellow man. But for oppression, also three are written, and you shall not oppress him, and you shall not oppress a stranger. And if you lend money to any of my people that is poor by thee, you shall not be to him as a usurer, which includes a proselyte. Both are forbidden by three injunctions. And this is from a much later time period than the Bible. This would be post-destruction of the Second Temple when we're living in exile and living surrounded mostly by people who are not Jewish at this time. And so part of our trajectory is a sacred text that is to be understood within a land that where we're sovereign, but the reality is that most of our existence has been in places where we had no sovereignty, and we've been in a place of resistance. So how do you develop long-term, over 2,000 years, an attitude towards the other while you're constantly resisting? Hmm. And that's been our story, is how to love the other when you are constantly the other, the eternal other. It has been taught, and this is also from the Talmud, Rabbi Eliezer the Great said, why did the Torah warn against the wrongdoing of a proselyte in the 36, or as others say, in 46 places? And so they're using stranger and proselyte interchangeably. Because he has a strong inclination to evil. What is the meaning of the verse, you shall neither wrong a stranger nor oppress him, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt? It has been taught, Rabbi Nathan said, do not taunt your neighbor with the blemish you yourself have. So this is about, this reminder, you are other, you are stranger. How do you hold that within yourself? What does it mean to be commanded to love? Who is a gregair, a stranger? How do we relate to them? And we have down below, he does, from Deuteronomy, he doth execute justice for the fatherless and the widow, and loves the stranger, and giving him food and raiment. Love ye therefore the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And actually we could go on and on and on because there's so many texts about loving the stranger. And what I wanted to bring to you this evening mostly was just this idea of being the stranger and learning to love the stranger at the same time. And what does that mean? This constant reminder of you yourself were a stranger. How is that supposed to impact us as we walk through this world? Not just love them, but remember your own identity as one who was the other. And this is such a challenge for American Jews right now, because we have a choice. For the last 50 years, the majority of us who are of European ancestry have been able to become white people, which is part of the reason why I feel so comfortable at Holden Village, is because this is my culture. This is how I live most of the time, is with white European people. And yet we know that whiteness can be revoked at any time, because it's happened to us before, that you could assimilate into and pretend to not be other and sort of try to blend in, but ultimately you're always the other. And so now we stand in this interesting place as our civilization turns. Who do we ally ourselves with? And, today, right now, there are people who are being arrested, who are trying to protect refugees, because they, like myself, I'm a child of a refugee who came to this country, and so many American Jews are children or grandchildren of refugees. But at the same time, it could be so easy to just be white people. You know, it could be so easy to just be white and not, and just blend in. Do we need to put ourselves on the front line? My answer is yes. We add that it casts a dark shadow over everything we've experienced for the last 2,000 years to not put ourselves on the line. And yet I know within our community that people who embody and feel strange and still feel like aliens, that it's hard to step out of your whiteness because it's become such a protection. And that's what I wanted to offer you today, was just this the complex nature of being the stranger and loving the stranger, and how that is manifest today in the American Jewish community. And I hope with all my heart, and I will do everything I can to lead as a rabbi of my own generation, to lead our people towards light and to not cast a shadow on our past, but to continue to be a light in this world.
Thank you. Thank you, Adam and Johanna. So I'm going to take us on a little tour here for a minute of some things I've been learning about myself as a cisgender white male, and I want you to know that I'm speaking for myself. So if you have a different story or you don't resonate with this story, then that's okay with me. So this is me, my family up on the top left there. It's my mom and dad, my brother Dennis, my sister Peggy. I was 11 years younger than my brother, 14 years younger than my sister. I was the little surprise miracle. That's me, confirmation class, preaching my very earnest little sermon. And then that's me over there with a head for basketball. My dad was a custodian in La Crosse, Washington. He had owned a grocery store. And then when I was about four and a half years old, that store burnt. I had an electrical fire, and then my mom and dad went bankrupt in a small town of 300 people. My family used to be a farmer family. We'll talk about that in a minute. And so, you know, people sort of distanced themselves and would call dad certain names. And then a few years later, my mother was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, which happened soon after dad became a custodian at the school. And so all my dad could do for me really was to spend a half hour playing basketball with me a day, because we had no money. We didn't have much. So I put my heart into that and had a great time playing. This is my wife, Cheryl. That's my wife, Cheryl, and I with our two babies in front of my dad, mom and dad's house. And that's my mom and dad shortly before her death in 2003. Our family, my great-grandpa, Jens Wiggen, came across from Norway in an 18-foot boat with 12 people from Norway. And they sailed across, came to New York because they had heard of a promise of free land. And so, you know, my grandpa Jens was a pretty brave man. He got in that boat, and they easily could have died. And this is the farm that he built there in Eastern Washington State. The church is just about a mile that way to the left of that photo. And you can see the big hills there behind, not all of which are farmed because they're just too steep. And this is a picture of them in the 1950s harvesting some of that wheat. With tractors pulling the combines. Of course, when my dad was a kid, they didn't have tractors. They had 22 mules that would pull the combines, the combine along, and they had to put all the wheat into sacks and carry it all around, and it was quite a tough operation. So where did this land come from? Used by and a part of the Palouse Indians, the Palos Indians in Eastern Washington State, that were moved out to become part of the Yakima tribe. I just was going through my photos of the day, just trying to find a few of these, and I found this. Mm-hmm. This is my brother next to a Native American at a roadside attraction of some kind or another, and my mom taking a photo, I think, from inside the car at this. And so this man, of course, was part of a people whose land was taken away. And it's estimated, you know, by a lot of different scholars that between 25 million and 100 million Native Americans died in the genocide of white people settling in this country. So I usually say 50 million, right? Which a lot of people think is still way too much. And so, you know, what I want to say is that when I grew up in church, in Lutheran church, they're full of very, very nice, kind people, and we would sing Jesus loves the little children of the world, red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. You know, I love that song. I love the idea of Jesus loving everybody. I didn't really understand where the land came from, and I didn't understand sort of how our family benefited from the oppression of Native American people. So I love that song, but when you got to be about 12 years old, 11 years old, you go out and stand with the farmers, with all the men out in the parking lot after church, and everybody would be out there kind of squishing gravel around with their feet, you know, because nobody wants to look at each other in Norwegian church, apparently. And so they're all like farming the gravel. And what I noticed very quickly was that the men would use racial slurs quite regularly, and not just, you know, little ones. But they would use as vicious ones as they could. I came home, of course, after my mother died. We had a funeral out at the church out there. We buried her up in the cemetery on the hill up behind the church. Land that was also taken from the Native Americans and given to the Lutherans out there. And I came down to the parking lot to stand in the circle with the men, because that's what you do. And then I started hearing racial slurs. Well, at this point, I'd already been to seminary. I'd already gone to PLU and met a lot of different folk. I became good friends with someone from Africa, actually, and worked with a lot of different people through my social work department, was at seminary and met just a ton of like really beautiful people that were very different from me. And so from somewhere in me on that exhausting day, I said, I would appreciate it if we didn't talk about other human beings that way. And of course, it's my mom's funeral. So they're not gonna fight me on my mom's funeral day. And I didn't stand there and say, hey, y'all a bunch of racists. I didn't say that. I just said what my positive values was. What I would want to say is that I was raised in white supremacy. Not the kind that like seeks to go out and hurt people, but the kind that doesn't mind if they're hurt. So I was raised in white supremacy. And in fact, we had an Aryan Nations group developing in my hometown. There was an old Baptist church just a half a block away from my home that was being used as an ammo depot for when they were going to rise up and take over the feds, which was kind of crazy. The FBI did come in and round up the leader of that, and that all kind of closed down. But you can see that this like nice little small town full of nice little church people were very easily swayed, you know, into this kind of like us against them, kind of violence against whites, this kind of white supremacist sort of thing. And so what I want to say is that I think Lutheran Christianity and many other forms of Christianity, because I'm a Lutheran, so I'm just going to say Lutheran, right, has been strained through white supremacy. So whatever country it came from, like we can say, well, Lutherans never owned slaves, which I don't think we can say that. But Lutherans out west, at least, can say they didn't own slaves, which I'm not sure that's always true, right? But they can say that, but we know that the Christianity that I grew up with, at least, was strained through the notion of white supremacy, and that we benefited from racial injustice. And what happens when you benefit from racial injustice like that? If you think of yourself as a good person, as a person that loves God, that wants to love your neighbor, well, you got to figure out a way in your own head and heart to make them less than human. Mm-hmm. Because then they deserve it. Because you're still a good person because you needed the land. So how did this sort of get started? Well, of course, you know, started, it's a difficult term, right? We could easily say that one of the biggest tragedies of the Christian tradition is when we were taken over by the Roman Empire. So, you know, Constantine and Theodosius and all those folk bringing in, making Christianity like a religion and then the religion of the Roman Empire was not a win. The empire wins those kind of debates a lot of times. And so the Christianity that began with Jesus proposing that the domination system, the power over other people system of the Roman Empire is not the way we have to live, soon became the Jesus lifted up as a person that was justifying the Crusades, various other kinds of things. So what we have, I think, another really critical moment in sort of the reduction of Christianity into white supremacy and the distortion of it was something called the Doctrine of Discovery. And of course, there really are doctrines of discovery, but I'm going to, in 1455 and then in 1493, that there were several papal bulls that were written to justify European and largely white, but European countries going over and going wherever they want to in the world, whether it's Africa or somewhere else, and they can, quote, discover a land if there's no Christians there. And in 1493, they said, but you can't fight over the land, so whoever kind of gets there first gets to keep that land. Because the church said, well, we want to convert those people to Christianity, right? And so that makes it okay to go over there and take their land and their resources and to sort of, you know, claim the people there and to claim them as slaves. And so we all know what happened in 1492. Columbus sailed across the ocean, found a land that belonged to other people, and then began a process, multi-year process of systematically killing and enslaving them so they could take their resources. And so that papal bull, if you look it up online and begin to do some research and reading about it, you'll find that those papal bulls still are really in large ways in effect legally as the basis of property ownership in this country. So that, like, they're actually relied upon by the Supreme Court for the laws of this country, because, of course, these white Europeans, mostly white Europeans, have a great right to go discover other people's property and use other people and all of their resources as they would. And so in 1862, Abraham Lincoln, history is complicated, and then there were other laws later that modified it, but came across with the Homestead Act, which is what my grandpa Jens saw probably a poster or heard a rumor about or saw something in some newspaper somewhere in Norway, in the southern part of Norway, and decided he'd come over here and take this free land. Well, it wasn't free land, it was stolen land. And so then we get this photo, this painting, by John Gast in 1872. And what do y'all see in this painting? Because we're recording, you know, I'll kind of narrate it a little bit, but if you see something I haven't seen, like, I'd love to hear it. You notice how light it is on the right-hand side. So for folks online, this is the John Gast photo from 1872. So, and you got, like, city over there with a harbor, and you got a train, you got another train. And then what do you have in this, like, slightly, this west? What do we have there? Darkness. What's going on? We have shadow happening there. And who's in the shadow?
Native Americans.
And what are they doing?
Fleeing.
They're retreating. Yeah. And we got buffalo, and what are they doing?
Retreating.
And we got white people coming along with a bear below, and of course the bear's retreating. Of course, sometimes we wish some of the bears would retreat out here at Holden, right? But you see what's happening there. So we have a dangerous bear, we've got the food for a whole bunch of Native American folk, and we've got this, like, movement of wagon trains, and can we see the color of the skin of the wagon trains? What's the color of the skin?
White.
And anybody know who this woman is? Sort of eagerly but leisurely, kind of at the same time, floating over the scene. Who is she? Anybody know?
Columbia.
That's Columbia. And what is Columbia? Columbia is the goddess of the spirit of Christopher Columbus. Okay, so you know what major river we're close to here, don't you?
Columbia.
Right. And you know what Washington, D.C. is called, right? Of Columbia. So Columbia, this is sort of like a spiritual manifestation of like Columbus's colonization and murder, right, and theft, sort of as this, and look at her skin. What do you think about her? Very, 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 very white. And I mean, and then there's a book that she's got.
Is that the Bible?
It is not the Bible, thank you, Jesus. But it just as well be, right? So she's got this like cable, first of all, let's talk about the cable.
Yeah,
telegraph, right? So she's like carrying the line, you know, right? To connect the East and the West, and then she's got this book. And the book literally says education. That's what it literally says. I mean, I was looking at it so closely last night. You can't hardly see it in this.
Well, it looks like it's supposed to portray progress. Yeah. Like that's, you know, that's the word that comes to mind.
Sure.
And so that, so people are brainwashed into seeing that right. This is what progress looks like.
Sure. And so I'm not saying like that this image, that this painting, I'm not saying that this sort of like goddess of Columbia, you know, the spirit of Columbus, like was all that influential. Like I'm not really sure about that. Like that's something I got to dig into a bit more. What I am saying is that this picture represented the white supremacy I grew up in better than any painting I've ever seen. Like the Native Americans should flee because we're coming. It's going to be our land. We don't care what happens. We want them to go away. We want them to go into concentration camps and be murdered.
So, Pastor Terry, as long as we're talking about Columbus, I got to throw this in.
Yeah.
So there's something that happened in 1492 that most Americans don't know about, and actually is completely related to this. Which is, I don't know if it was in the same papal bull, but there was another in that same year that basically gave Isabella and Ferdinand the legal justification to expropriate all the resources that the Jewish population in Spain had. And it was those resources that allowed them to finance Columbus to come to this country. And Jews were basically expelled from Spain in 1492. Many went to Morocco, some went to Italy, but the entire Jewish population that had lived actually under, you know, I don't know my history, but it was before Isabella, and you know.
That was the date. Yeah, 1492.
But the Arab.
Yeah, that was until then.
The Caliphate. Yeah. They lived just fine under that regime for centuries, and accumulated lots of, you know, land. Well, that was taken over by Isabella and Isabella Fernandez, and that's what financed the Age of Discovery for Spain.
Right, and of course, it's the age of exploitation, the age of theft, the age of murder, right? So it was funded by murder and exploitation and racism, and it Christianized it, right? It said, well, this is, and so again, like, I'm just telling you, this photo represents the this is like the lens or the strainer through which Lutheran Christianity in my home congregation was created. And so here is just a photo of like the valley below Nazareth, right? And so where did Jesus, what's the social location of Jesus? Jesus was born, according to Christians, of a young woman who became pregnant out of wedlock. She became married to a carpenter. And we know that carpenters were only a step or two above tanners, were right at the very bottom of the social scale in a town of about 100 people in Nazareth in Galilee that was not well thought of, in an occupied country by the Roman Empire, and so that Jesus was born, really, and what was really otherwise the moment he was born. And we know, you know, the story of Jesus, that he was seen as a threat and became a stranger, became a refugee in Egypt. And then finally, after Herod the Great, the not-so-great, died, he was able to come back in his family. So, you know, many of us know the Christian story very well, so I'm just not going to go into too much, but it's like, within Christian tradition, part of what that's saying is that whenever someone is otherized, like, that's where God is. That God always begins the healing of an entire culture, an entire economic system, an entire, like, set of relationships with people by joining with the most vulnerable. Like, that's kind of what Lutherans and Christians in general, I think, really take from that story. And so it's not just that Jesus says to love others, that he was. I know he experienced that. And so, you know, when he begins to proclaim about the reign of God, what does the reign of God look like? He goes and he reads from the book of the prophet Isaiah, which is the most quoted text in the New Testament. And he says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because God has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. God has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free and proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." What are all of those people listed there? They're folk that are being otherized, and that the very salvation that Jesus was offering from God was to change their situation and to change the entire culture into what Jesus, you know, called the kingdom of God, or the reign of God. And so much so that in Matthew 25, which is a verse that we know so well, the king will say to those in the last judgment, "Come to you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you gave me clothing. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me." So this is the key value of Jesus' message, is that when we see a person or a community under threat, we recognize that God isn't telling us to help them, is that God is identified with them, and when we stand with them in solidarity to bring healing, that in fact we're standing with God in them. That is so incredibly powerful, I think. And that's why, like, when I encounter people who hate Muslims and they ask me questions about why I'm doing it, I just simply say, because of Jesus. And I say, because I love Jesus. And then, of course, you know, we've got the Good Samaritan, but I'm going to skip that. So what we have going on right now in the country, and it's been happening for millennia, right? But we have to understand what it is. There is dehumanization, again, being intensified, I think, at the moment. And this is what dehumanization does. This is how it works. An influencer proposes an us and a them, and then they cause us to begin to fear the them as a threat. And the fear becomes real even if the threat is not. The fear becomes real even if the threat is not. And we're tempted to fear this otherized group for our physical existence. We're to fear them for their threat to the vulnerable and to our way of life. And then as this fear begins to get cultivated purposefully, there's an application of collective blame for any action of the group upon the whole. And the purpose of dehumanization is to justify harm against the them, against those otherized. That is the purpose of it. So dehumanization does not just make people who intend evil more likely to do it. It does that too. It begins to help people who want to do good, who want to love neighbor, to start asking the question, well, who is my neighbor? Well, those people aren't my neighbor. Those people are a threat. It's either us or them. And this ultimately leads people to believe that this violence against this otherized group is necessary, perhaps heroic, and morally justified. That's the way the process works, say a lot of scholars. This is from a group called Project Over Zero. And then what people don't realize is that this leads also to a cycle of violence that decreases everyone's safety. So Brother Martin Luther, in his talk about the Eighth Commandment, says, we should fear and love God so that we do not tell lies about our neighbor, betray her, slander her, or hurt her reputation, but defend her, speak well of her, and explain everything in the kindest way. Which is, of course, a teaching that Luther himself failed at with reference to many people, including Roman Catholics, our Jewish neighbors, and our Muslim neighbors. So Luther was not perfect, I'm afraid, and the sad reality is his words about our Jewish neighbors set the stage for the Holocaust in many, many ways. So Martin Luther King Jr., of course, teaches us, in the end, we will remember the words of our enemies, not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. Mm-hmm. And so in this time of great dehumanization of our Muslim neighbors, of our Jewish neighbors, of our Latinx neighbors, by both intentional hate groups and by elected officials. One elected official, our president, in the last couple of days, led a campaign rally in which he said that the four women, Rashida Tlaib, Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and help me...
Ina Presley,
should go back to their country.
Go
back where they came from.
Wait, that's Minnesota.
Yeah,
I know. And so, you know, and there's so many examples of the kind of rhetoric that we see, both from politicians, from hate groups, from people who are still surrounded and informed by white Christian supremacy, to otherize, demonize, make fearful folk that they find fearful and threatening. And what we have to understand is that that will lead to violence. Now, I know I spoke a little too long, so I'm sorry about that. So what I want to say is I am recovering and repenting of white Christian supremacy. That is what I'm doing. And I want to say very clearly in my work of advocacy, in my work to partner with my Muslim neighbors and my Jewish neighbors, I ain't doing it for them. I'm doing it for Jesus, right? I'm doing it for the creator of the universe, and I'm doing it for our mutual healing. Because I don't want to live that way. And I never did. But I was raised in it. I was raised in that, in the image of that terrible picture. That's the Christianity that I thought was... I mean, the only thing missing from that is a church.
Yeah.
Or her carrying the Bible.
Yeah, or her carrying the Bible. But, the separation of church and demon, I guess. But there's a demonic spirit right there. She may look all nice, but she's a demonic spirit. And we gotta trust in God to cast that out of our faith, because it leads to death and violence. So,
Terry, do we realize that we have a half hour less today? So we have about another 35 minutes.
I didn't realize that.
I just found that out.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering if that causes us to rethink. I mean, I think people are planning, it's to 4:15, right? I mean, yeah. That's, great. Yeah.
Okay, that's my bad. So
we maybe want to think, I mean.
Yeah. Could we go longer? Is there a reason? Is there something else in this room?
Just to honor people, the schedule. I mean, yeah. I think it's, you know.
I'm sorry about that. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I just checked it now.
So let's just do a little Q&A. And then we'll move to you guys. Is that okay? Just for like 7-8 minutes. Okay, is that okay? All right, yes, ma'am.
Just real quick, the Homestead Act.
Yeah.
Is, and the beautiful National Park, quote, monument is in Beatrice, Nebraska. And they have done, if you can ever go there, they've done a phenomenal job of dealing with, this is all stolen land, folk. And you could say, I'm so happy my grandpa got this land, but you need to know where this land came from.
Yeah.
And they're very straightforward about it, and questions about it, and posters about it, and I want you to think about this. So it's not a, when I first thought of it, I thought, oh, this is going to be just, they're going to ignore. No, they don't ignore it. So it's a special day.
So it's not just that. You don't have to be exposed to the N-word to be to recognize that we've all been socialized through the foundation of our country from white supremacy. It is the foundational root of our country, and we have to explore that and own it as white people.
Right.
And until we do, we won't go through any of this stuff.
That's right. Yeah. Amber.
So I have a question. So in the Christian tradition, a lot of emphasis is also on like loving your enemy.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that, because like we talked about like loving the stranger, love, if that's seen in the Jewish or Muslim traditions in terms of people who not only that are not just different but have like wronged you in a way, and if that, if there's any, I'm just wondering.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a verse that we saw yesterday, fight those who fight you. But that's obviously in a time of war where there's fighting going on and you have to defend yourself. But there's another verse that says that, you know, if you treat your enemy well, he could or she could become your best of friends. So that also exists, this idea that people's hearts can change and that God controls people's hearts and that God can flip people's hearts from hate to love. And we've seen that on the playground all the time, right? And that applies to adults as well.
I think, you know, it's nuanced in Judaism in that we have texts that say you should always begin war with starting peace. You know, that we should always try to lead with peace and try to have peaceful relationships. But we also have this thing where you're not allowed to forgive someone who did, unless they did it to you personally. So we don't have forgiveness for groups. Like it's actually forbidden to forgive someone unless they personally wronged you. So there's this idea that, you know, for example, like we can't forgive all the Germans for World War II. That's just like not possible. But if someone comes to you and they had stolen your property, then you can forgive them. So forgiveness is something that's more individual and not national. And so that sort of shapes, I think, the whole idea of your relationship to the person who's wronged you is really a more on an individual basis.
All right, I think we should turn it over to Faith Action. So let's all stand up for a second. And let's get Amber's thing hooked up. And if we can make it hooked up.
I discovered that.
It's fine. It's a team thing.
So should we learn our lesson from the
Lord?
It's the point again. So
All right. Just because we're kind of playing with a little bit less time than our last two workshops, I'm going to just jump right in. It's going to be really similar to the structure for folks who've been with us on Monday and Wednesday, where we're going to kind of talk about the world as it is now and how that is kind of counter to what our traditions
are telling us about how we should treat our neighbor and how we should treat other people. And I like to start us and transition us over by usually reading something. I'm not going to read this whole thing because we are playing with time, but I found this on the Marshall Project, and they do a lot on criminal justice, and it's a personal narrative. And the title is, I'm 31, I'm a lawyer, and I'm still getting stopped by the police. It's by David Arlich. So late one afternoon in March 2018, I had just left work to meet a friend in Brooklyn when cops stopped me on the street. I had just graduated from law school, so I knew enough to keep my mouth shut. I invoked my rights, but it didn't matter. They still tried to get me to admit something I didn't do. After 7 long hours in the precinct, they told me I could leave without charging me with anything. I had a big test coming up the next morning, the MPRE, the professional ethics portion of the bar exam. By the time I returned home from the precinct around 2 a.m., I couldn't sleep. I was still going on adrenaline. Still, I showed up, took the exam, and passed. But when I got home, that was when it all hit. That's when I started crying and thinking about how, even at this point in my life, despite everything I've accomplished, this is still happening to me. So sometimes I think, for me at least, when I'm especially transitioning to policy work, stories are really important and they really help ground me and continue in my advocacy. I do a lot around criminal justice in particular, and folks in our prison tend to be otherized often, and it's those connections and those relationships that have helped me kind of really work on my criminal justice work. So those are some examples, but let's start to kind of think about, what are you seeing? I mean, this is hitting us in the face on a day-to-day basis, it feels like. What do we see in our world today where there are policies in place or ways that we are otherizing our neighbors?
Can I put up your example?
Sure, go for it.
Policing of, or police
people of color.
And I teach down in San Diego at a Title I school, and this year we had more than one family that had to leave the country because of this whole undocumented immigration fear of having their family split up.
Absolutely.
Nationalism. America's the best. Everybody else is bad. You've cheated us in the past. Let's make America great again.
The Muslim ban.
Yeah. Family detention. Mm-hmm. Our kids in cages. All kinds of.
I think criminalizing homelessness.
Yeah.
I even think something around not having resources for like mental health or things like that.
Especially in schools.
Yeah.
So you could be dramatic and say sort of, well, okay, inadequate mental health. I was going to say, gutting of the mental health system better.
Yeah. White saviors.
Say it again, white saviors?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Say more about that. Well, just that there's, even when we're trying to do the right thing, sometimes just speaking and saying, I can solve this problem before you get it. And that continues the other idea.
Kind of like this power dynamic.
Yeah.
What else?
Gay and straight?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
LGBT rights.
Same, yeah. How would you put it in terms of a bad thing? Like victimizing of LGBTQ? I mean,
How about the policy against the transgender in the military?
Yes.
Folks.
And bathroom laws?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Rent laws?
Dead marriage?
So can we make a broad category or something, like discrimination, otherizing of LGBTQI?
Weaponized media.
Women who seek abortion or people that provide abortion.
I don't know. This is it. Mia, I don't know if this fits on this list, but also just making it a fearful place for us to help the other. You know, so making it difficult for sanctuary cities and all of,
like the people that put out water in the desert.
Right.
Arrested. They're being arrested.
But I don't, maybe that's a different level.
Voting suppression and gerrymandering?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Voter suppression and gerrymandering.
Mm-hmm. Well, lying is a big exercise these days. Tell the truth.
I would say school discipline too. The disproportionate number of students of color are suspended and expelled from schools.
Say that again.
How do I say it?
School discipline?
Thank you, yes.
Okay,
so disproportionality in school discipline.
I don't mean to be flip, but California. And what that means to me is that a large part of the country looks at liberal California as the other.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm.
You know, so you could say liberals, you could say whatever, but, you know.
I mean Western style democracy.
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
All right. Any other last ones? Yeah, this political polarization.
Sure.
Yeah, that definitely is divisive.
And just building on that about the discipline in school, the whole school to prison thing that goes all the way up.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. School, the school to prison pipeline.
All right, so we have quite a list again, and if you've been with us for the first two workshops, you'll know we're really good at finding the things that are wrong. So the next challenge is for us, and Carol's going to explain it a little bit more because we're working with time.
I'm sort of wondering if that maybe we, instead of breaking into small groups, yeah, that we do some of this just together, because I'm seeing some nodding. Because what I would propose that we do is what we've been doing the last two sessions is we've been trying to identify policies, changes in policy that respond to the realities that we have listed. And to get there, we have identified, you know, which ones are most concerned to us, and then also what are the faith values that we've heard that that lead us to that. I would like to propose something a little different, which is that we jump right to responses to these, and that we include not only like, that we'll broaden it out a little bit from what we've done in the past days, which is not only to talk specifically about public policy, say, legislation at the state or national level. That's good too. But also responses that faith communities can make, civic communities can make, organizations can make to try to address these realities. So, if you know, vigils in response to mass shootings would be one. That's not a legislative thing, but that's a community thing. Does that sound like we could, because we've got, you know, a little more than 15 minutes, and we'd love to hear any examples that people have, especially if you have, in fact, participated in some of these things, or you just have maybe ideas about how to address some of these, or things you know people are working on, okay? I mean, we could even sort of go down the list. I mean, what about issues around policing? I mean, what responses to that?
So I sit on the police oversight, community oversight group in our county.
Okay.
And one of the things that is very difficult but important, critically important, is accountability around use of force by police departments or sheriff's departments. And in California, we have a couple of bills that look like they're going to go through this year. Again, us, California, not them. That's our otherness. but one of which would change the standard by which an officer can use deadly force from what's called the reasonable standard. Yeah. It's not the full necessary standard, and we don't have to get it, but it's moving towards where it really has to be necessary for the officer in terms of how a court's going to judge whether it was right or wrong. And the important thing about that in relation to the otherness issue is part of the either explicit or unconscious judgment that is used in the use of force is really clearly how the officer perceives threat. And for better or worse, people of color, poor people, people who live in the wrong neighborhoods are disproportionately the victims of that use of force. So use of force policy changes, I think, is critically important.
You want to talk about Faith Action Networks, one of our successes in Washington State.
Washington State just went through this process. Mm. We just passed, actually via initiative. So we just passed via initiative essentially changes to our deadly force laws, where we are increasing the amount of training to include especially like anti-racism training and racial bias training. And we have also changed kind of the statute around like when you're able to actually use deadly force so that there is a way to hold law enforcement accountable, because Washington State had one of the worst statutes that prosecutors wouldn't even take a police officer to. They wouldn't even try to prosecute them because they wouldn't get it. So we worked really hard. This was a two-year process. We tried to get it through the legislature. In Washington State, we have the initiative process, and we were able to get it on the ballot, and it passed with a pretty wide margin. And so we're in the implementation phase of that right now. It's been awesome because it's had community involvement. So communities have been talking about what does that look like, what does that training need to include. We're in the process right now on figuring out what the accountability piece looks like. And community also is participating in that.
And law enforcement. I mean, this is a really cool thing, in part because there's been major involvement of law enforcement in this and supporting this. So it's a bridging issue, and it's exciting to hear that you're involved in a local group about that accountability, because this is a kind of thing, if you live in this state or California, a place where this has been passed, then to go to your local municipality, your local police, and say, I'm really interested in this. I want to know what's happening locally. How can I participate? How can I be on it? Yeah, great example.
Yeah.
Really good. What about the school to prison pipeline? That's a huge.
We have to, get your school district to learn about and implement restorative justice rather than, zero tolerance, and have to give educators trained in what it means to have experienced toxic stress in childhood and how we look at children and say what happened to you rather than what's wrong with you. And when you get your educators trained in that, it has a whole different effect on how we educate our youth.
And some more role models, right? So more varied racial experiences in educators too.
Yeah. I know, and I'm not sure if this passed, but there was a law, because we were like suspending and expelling preschoolers.
Oh, yeah.
And so I don't know if there's something that passed, but they were even just looking at, what are we doing? we're not going to do that. We're going to look for alternative ways.
But until people understand the way the brain develops and how the first 1,000 days of life, you're building a million neural connections per second in that little baby's brain. And if that baby's brain is in fight or flight in the first few years of life, then they learn to adapt to that. And when they go to school, that's where they're at, because they're always defending themselves against a perceived or potential threat. because that's what's happening in their neighborhood, that's what's happening in their home. And so, you know, maybe they're fidgety, but it's because their brain has a ton of cortisol bouncing around. Mm-hmm. So until educators understand that and try to educate children from that place, they're going to continue to say that kid's bad, get them out of the classroom.
But they may understand it, but there may not be funds in place to have individual. But yeah, I feel like that's really important.
But you can have a system that in your school that has different policies about how you deal with it.
That may be a good segue too to deportations. A couple of us were talking earlier today about the trauma for children who live in fear every day that they're going to come home from school and their parents aren't going to be there. But about deportations, which we're looking at right now, big time. So what are some responses to that, policy-wise, faith community-wise? I mean, throw out some. Obviously, sanctuary has been one. I mean, are any of your churches, or you know? And we know that yesterday that man who was in sanctuary at Gethsemane Lutheran in Seattle was detained.
His name is Jose Robles.
Jose Robles. Another thing, are people aware of, we did have another legislative success, Keep Washington Working, which doesn't sound like it's related to deportations, but you want to say something about that?
Sure. It's actually gone through, and the reason why we called it that way is because we're realizing the value that immigrants have in our community. I mean, literally, the messaging was around how, like, folks together are keeping our economies thriving. And so what it does is it essentially separates the connection between local law enforcement and ICE. So, you know, it, you know, restricts the information that can be reported to ICE about individuals, and so that there's more of a safety barrier, because oftentimes when you've seen, you've heard the stories where, you know, different departments or state departments have been sharing information with the federal government, and that's been leading to more detentions and deportations. And so that's also in the implementation process right now, and we're going to definitely have to have some more community, really making sure that the law is working in a way that's actually benefiting our communities. It was a pretty powerful.
SB 54.
Yeah, and the sometimes that's referred to as sanctuary city, sanctuary states. In other words, that we, by law, are refusing to pass that information on.
At the end of July, the Archdiocese of Seattle, along with Catholic Community Services, organized a pilgrimage, walking and witnessing for immigrant families. Over 70 parishes were involved in that, and culminated in a mass in front of the Northwest Detention Center. Mm-hmm. Again, awareness is just one step. But
yeah.
You can also something small, like training people about what are your rights if you get stopped or someone knocks on your door, and, you know, churches or county offices can pass out cards to people about who to call, what to do, and what your rights are.
Great.
Well, kind of like along with that, I'm in Northern California, and one of my friends who is a Quaker, I know their group is all, they've been trained that if somebody shows up, ICE shows up at somebody's door, they can call one of the
rapid response
networks.
Yeah.
You
might make sure they check and make sure that they have the proper warrants and all that jazz. And it sounds like a pretty good program that anybody could do.
Also, just, we obviously need a better path to citizenship, which is something that, we're constantly trying to work on at the federal level.
Yeah.
Brandon and I were in one lunch in Mexico, and we were sitting in a town square, and there were scads of school buses with school children coming to the square, and they came out of the buses, and they had different signs. They were carrying signs. And I didn't even speak Spanish, but I asked one person what was happening, and apparently part of their curriculum was teaching kids how to be citizens by protesting the things that were wrong in society. And I thought that would be a great thing to do.
Yeah.
What about the Muslim ban? I mean, I know that that MAPS has been very involved. MAPS, that the mosque where Imam Adam is from, that there's national legislation, right? I mean, is there?
Yes, there is. There's currently national legislation proposed by quite a few folk. In both the House and the Senate to repeal the Muslim ban. It's not probably going to get into the Senate. And because of that, it may not get brought up in the House. But there are a lot of national organizations, the Shoulder to Shoulder Campaign, Muslim Advocates, the Council on American Islamic Relations. You can check out any of those websites and let your representatives hear. I mean, allies, people are being dehumanized on the basis of religion. People, especially with the majority religion, need to stand up and recognize that it is our responsibility to stand up before our Muslim neighbors. Of course, the Muslim ban's only a part of it. You've got every time a Muslim goes to an airport, what do you think happens? They are randomly selected.
Right.
Unrandomly selected. A friend of mine went through the border. They thought he was Mexican. They started to speak to him in Spanish. The officer looked down at his card and saw the name Muhammad, got so nervous he dropped the card on the floor. And after 45 minutes of being in the other room, they walked in and said, "You're okay." Of course, the dude works for Boeing. It has run for political office. And so the officer came out and said, "Well, we read about you. You're okay, but you really should think about changing your name."
This is not a public policy thing, but I remember when the airport ban, people were stuck in airports. Uber drivers crossed the line, and Lyft, as a company, said, "No, we're not going to cross the picket line. I don't do Uber anymore." I mean, there are corporate governance initiatives that you can also potentially look at, because there are some companies that, are more progressive around policies like that.
Yeah.
And frankly, if you have assets to invest, you can also vote with your money in terms of which companies you're going to support, because there are some who, are part of that. I want to learn more about this, Islamophobia industry. Because there's money behind that.
There is a lot.
And you can move your investments towards things that are better and worse in that regard. It's not the same as public advocacy, I understand.
No, there's one thing, especially given what Terry shared, that I want to make sure that we bring up, because it's not a, it is. It has to do with passage of an act related to murdered and missing indigenous women and in the state of Washington. Because, I mean, when you think of the otherization of, of the original inhabitants, and so, I mean, that we got a piece of legislation passed, and this was really important for Faith Action Network. Did a lot of work and lobbying on it. I guess my understanding is that they're going to add like this funding for two staff people to work with local law enforcement to try to to follow up and clear cases. So that's
Another thing that was really cool that FAN and I'm sure other organizations we do a lot of work with the unions during Ramadan one year, a lot of like airport workers and some of the janitors weren't getting, they're fasting all day, and so they were being really inflexible in terms of when they were able to break their fast. So a lot of us were like, "Yo, you can't do that. That's not okay." So we were talking to in conversation with some of the businesses around like that were contracted with the airport to try to be trying to figure out like scheduling around that, and also with prayer and things like that. Mm-hmm. So,
We haven't, we've done police, but criminal justice, there have been, you know, and that's one of, I mean, there some of the, on the list of things, some of the reforms, you want to talk about any of those that we got this year? I mean, that.
So, I mean, we expanded higher education in prison this year. So for a while, Washington State had a ban that, you know, if they were, people were incarcerated, there would be no public dollars to help folks get above a GED. A few years ago, we, you know, got some funding to get to an associate's degree. This year, we've expanded it a bit more. So I think there are some bachelor programs that are going to be available, but also expanding it for folks based on their time there. Because some people were just automatically, why invest in you? You have life without parole. Why invest in you? You're going to be in here for 50 years. So it's expanded eligibility for those groups as well. I know that we were working to get some more funding around housing. Because oftentimes when you're coming out of prison, finding a job is already really difficult. And then housing costs are constantly rising here. So there's a program that gives kind of like housing vouchers.
And then also some reform of 3-3 strikes law, pulling out.
We create other when we put people in prison.
Yeah, 100%.
90% of those are going to be coming out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a way that we can help by instituting a transition program coming out of prison? Because these people, largely young, don't have a lot of the skills of cooking, just everyday skills that men and women both need to be able to represent themselves and take care of themselves, so that they don't end up in the street.
Yeah, I think there are definitely efforts, and I mean this is done a lot more on the nonprofit realm. But there are definitely efforts like on reentry and trying to get folks. Of course, there could be more, and they could be better. But that's definitely something we need to work on. One of my goals in life is to get everybody to go to a prison, at least because I think that talk about taking down a wall of other and actually find a community amongst the folks who are there. So,
can you give us a field trip?
I mean, I got come to my workshop tomorrow. we can talk.
Could you just talk before we wrap up? We talked the whole way. Could you just also, in terms of the, you're talking about the subjects, but there's also the process of demystifying meeting with your legislator, because it is incredibly powerful and it's not hard. And particularly those of you who are thinking about retiring, in some time, it's really fun to have those conversations, and it has a huge impact. You don't realize it. Even calls have an impact, but actually, on the day they're in the district, going down to their office, sitting with them on any one of these issues and educating them, because most of these people are so busy with lobbyists, who are spitting stuff in their ears, they really appreciate when a real person who's not paid to talk to them.
And a person of faith, too.
And a person of faith, yeah. So could you talk about that process?
We're going to do that tomorrow.
Oh,
we got a 2-hour session tomorrow. where we're going to talk about more about Faith Action Network and how we do that organizing, and we're even going to do, I think, some role plays about messaging, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like the practice, if you were going to go in to your legislator, or you're going to meet with them in a coffee shop where you live, off session, what would you say about, from your values basis, about an issue? And we're going to do some of that tomorrow. So I think.
Good.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's great.
We did this a little differently, but I think this is a good list, and there's obviously other things we could put up here. But I think one of the things that's exciting is that there are legislative things that we can do, but then we can work at really the community level. I mean, a lot of this, there are national level things which are huge, like immigration reform, but it's amazing how many things you can do locally, and that in a state that like, some of our states that really are trying to break that, that a tie between law enforcement and ICE. I mean, that's important. So, any last words?
Anybody? Thank you for being here. We'll see some of you tomorrow.
Then, so right afterwards, we want to take a photo with not only some of the teacher people, because Adam and Johanna will be leaving tomorrow, but with anybody who came here, especially because of Interfaith Week or really enjoyed Interfaith Week, we'd love to have a photo with you, right now. Would that be okay? So let's go out and take a photo together. And we'll also need a photographer, of course, and you'll be banished from the photo, but that's the way that goes. So thank you all for coming to our conversation.